of the bottom billion are resource-rich and policy-poor. In these countries, providing more finance through aid simply misses the point. Our trade policy doesn't have much potential either, since these countries are going to find it difficult to diversify their exports because of Dutch disease, regardless of any preferences we might give them. They may well need military assistance from time to time, inasmuch as natural resource wealth makes a country more prone to conflict, but I have covered that one in the preceding section. So the key instrument of intervention is likely to be our own laws and international norms. We need that charter for resource wealth, something like a revised version of the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. There is a tendency to dismiss this approach by pointing to some difficult countries in which it is likely to be impotent. When the idea of something like the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative was first floated, the skeptics often pointed to Angola and said, "Forget it." The recent history of the initiative suggests that this was too pessimistic. Both the Kimberley Process and the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative show that even very modest steps can get some traction. Nor have the skeptics come up with any better solution. Somehow the colonial fantasy persists that we have hard power. We don't, and we never will. Surely after Iraq, the chances of a wealthy country attempting external military intervention to transform a badly governed, resource-rich country are zero. We can, however, help to empower the reformers within the societies of the bottom billion. Or we can sit on our hands while our oil companies compete with the Chinese in the bribery game. Our public inaction does not mean that the rich world is passive. It means that the powerful forces of globalization continue to side with the political crooks in these societies. Lifelines for the landlocked. We do not have instruments that are sufficiently powerful to break the trap of being landlocked with bad neighbors. In the end, the landlocked must depend upon more fortunate neighbors making the most of their opportunities, and so for the landlocked trap to be broken, the other traps must be broken first. But there is still much that we can do to mitigate the problem. Aid. Yes, certainly, and on a substantial scale. These countries are going to be poor for a long time, and they will need our money not just to develop, but to live decently. However, the aid will need to be provided more effectively than in the past. It would make things much simpler if governance and policies in these countries were sufficiently decent for us to provide money unencumbered. Malawi, Burkina Faso, and Uganda should all be receiving massive budget support because governance is already somewhat reformed in these places. But countries where governance remains debilitating, such as Chad and the Central African Republic, need a different approach, such as governance conditionality and independent service authorities. We should also be giving some aid to the neighbors, earmarked for transport corridors. Remember that large aid inflows into poor countries increase the risk of a coup d'etat, presumably because the army catches the scent of money. Even if the military does not actually mount a coup, the threat of one induces the government to increase the military budget preemptively, and some of the funds for this come from the aid itself. So there is a particular role in these countries for external military guarantees against coups. We could legitimately use these guarantees to reinforce the incentives for decent governance. A government might be given a guarantee only if it subjected itself to the effective scrutiny of its own citizens. In other words, a condition might be that the country should adhere to the international charters on democracy and budget transparency that I proposed in Chapter 9. Our trade policy does not have that much traction for the development of the landlocked because of the natural barrier of transport costs. However, especially for the countries of the Sahel, which, though landlocked, are close to Europe, air freight offers a potential lifeline into European markets. The key export products are likely to be high-value horticulture, and so European trade policy does matter. Breaking the reform impasse in failing states. Countries with bad governance and policies do sometimes turn themselves around, but too often it is like waiting for Godot. Reform in these countries has to come from within, and it takes courage. Vested interests can be relied upon to use their power, resources, and ingenuity to oppose change. Although the reformers have truth on their side, truth is just another special interest, and not a particularly powerful one. The villains willing to lie in order to defeat change have an advantage over those constrained by honesty. Reformers do not have it easy. When Charles Soludo became governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, his priority was to reform the banking sector, a notorious epicenter of rent-seeking. Unsurprisingly, this was not popular with the rent-seekers among the banks. They organized a fighting fund of around $2 million to campaign against him. Among other tactics, this enabled them to buy allies in the media. Charles did not have $2 million to oppose them. He just had guts and intelligence and the right arguments. As I write, he seems to have won, closing and merging 64 banks. Reform is tough, but it can triumph. The day after President Mwai Kibaki replaced the rent-seeking Daniel Arap Moi in Kenya in 2002, ordinary Kenyan citizens frog-marched police officers who demanded the usual bribes to their own police stations to be arrested. People believed that change was at last possible. President Kibaki brought in John Gitongo, who had headed the Kenyan branch of Transparency International, as his advisor on fighting corruption. However, once given access to the books, the new team realized the daunting nature of the political problem they faced. The Kenya African National Union, KANU, the former governing party, had over its years of corruption built up a war chest of around $1 billion, naturally held abroad and standing ready to be used in future campaigns. When the scale of what they were up against became apparent, some voices in the new team wanted to emulate the KANU strategy of grand corruption. The British High Commissioner was so dismayed by what he witnessed about the misuse of aid money that he spoke out about the villains vomiting it up in their greed. In the ensuing struggle for the heart of the new government, John Gitongo resigned. The story of his struggle must await his telling. 7 months later, in December 2005, the government was defeated in a referendum. The future of reform in Kenya is still not without hope, but now it looks far less promising than at the moment of KANU's defeat. Kwesi Bochwe, the finance minister who was critical to the turnaround in Ghana during the 1980s, managed to secure the promise of aid from a donor meeting in Paris. When he returned from his trip, he rather expected to be greeted by his colleagues in government as a hero, as the situation in the country had become desperate. Instead, they were intensely hostile. He gradually realized that this was because they assumed that he had personally pocketed the money and were jealous. Eventually, he quit when President Rawlings's nephew single-handedly smashed the national budget. Two of these three brave men are currently exiles. The third has placed his family in Europe due to death threats. What we are called upon to do is the safe task of making it easier for such people to win their struggle. Aid can most surely help, but it can also hinder, and so it should be offered intelligently. In Chapter 7, I set out the new evidence on when aid helps reform and when it hinders reform. Intelligent aid would require a substantial reorganization of how technical assistance is delivered. There will, however, surely be resistance in the agencies. How about military intervention in assisting turnarounds? I think that it is evident that after Iraq, even the most ghastly dictators are safe from external military intervention. Far from setting a precedent, it has drawn a line. Regime change is going to have to rely on other means. Guarantees against coups might come in handy during turnarounds, but that is probably as far as it goes. In regard to trade policy, it is a bit premature in these early reform environments to look to export diversification as a big driver of growth. New exports are more likely to get going after governance and policies have been transformed, rather than during the process of change. However, a credible prospect of diversification, based on successes in neighboring countries, would probably help to sustain reform. How about our laws and international norms? Here, I think, are our important missed opportunities. Our laws are going to be critical in reining in corruption. International charters can provide reformers both with an instrument with which to berate poor governance and with a goal around which to unite. That is why international charters will be opposed. Breaking out of limbo. Finally, how about limbo? Some of the coastal resource-scarce countries managed during the 1990s to break out of the traps, but it was too late. China and India were already established on the block in global markets, making the entry of latecomers much harder. How can we help to shoehorn these countries into the international market? And how can we give newly reforming governments the ability to make their commitments more credible, not just to foreigners, but to their own people, and so get a surge in private investment? Remember that aid is a two-edged sword as far as exporting is concerned, because of the Dutch disease it generates. The solution to this is a big push. Large but temporary aid targeted on raising export infrastructure up to globally competitive levels. It must be temporary because it is only once the aid stops that the Dutch disease problem stops. Like smart technical assistance, big push aid for exporting will need a transformation within the aid agencies. As for providing a commitment technology for reform, remember that aid in the form of donor conditionality has probably been part of the problem. It is hard to imagine circumstances in which military intervention would be useful in helping countries break into global markets. Perhaps, however, the catastrophic manner of the political transition to reform in Madagascar might have been averted with more decisive external support for the democratic process. Recall that the defeated president blockaded the port for 8 months, killing the export processing zone. While laws and charters are not directly useful for export diversification, an investment charter would encourage private investment. Not only does rapid growth require a massive increase in private investment, but the new activities that constitute export diversification will need investment. Evidently, the intervention that is critical for export diversification is trade policy. To my mind, it is absolutely vital. Without effective temporary protection against the Asian giants, the countries of the bottom billion will not break into new global markets. Their governments will not even try because they lack belief in themselves and expect to fail. I once suggested to a senior civil servant in the trade ministry of one of the countries of the bottom billion that they focus on new global markets. His response was, "It's like looking at the sun." And remember, with trade preferences, the devil is in the details. Who should make it happen? There is no world government. That is probably a good thing, but even if you really hope for one, you must face up to the fact that it is not going to happen. At least not in a time frame that is relevant for the problem faced by the bottom billion. Remedying the problems of the bottom billion is a global public good, and so, like the provision of all such public goods, it is going to be difficult. Mobilizing changes in aid policy. The key obstacle to reforming aid is public opinion. The constituency for aid is suspicious of growth, and the constituency for growth is suspicious of aid. Therefore, using aid strategically to promote growth in the bottom billion is not high on the agendas of politicians. Public opinion drives them into the "I care" photo opportunities that dominate aid. To her immense credit, the former British Secretary of State for International Development, Claire Short, resisted this temptation, on principle de-linking disbursements of aid from her own visits, but she is no longer a strong political actor in this arena. Aid agencies should become increasingly concentrated in the most difficult environments. That means that they will need to accept more risk, and so a higher rate of failure. They should compensate by increasing their project supervision, which means higher administrative overheads. They should become swift-footed, seizing reform opportunities at an early stage. They should intervene strategically, financing big push strategies for export diversification. They should introduce governance conditionality. At present, the powerful force of popular opinion is driving agencies in precisely the opposite direction. They cannot afford failure. They have to be lean with low administrative expenses. They have to prioritize long-term social objectives rather than short-term opportunities for reform and growth. They have to give unconditional debt relief. This is the fault of ordinary citizens who support vociferous lobbies without bothering to get informed. No aspect of domestic policy is run this badly. The aid agencies are not run by fools. They are full of intelligent people severely constrained by what public opinion permits. Mobilizing changes in military intervention. Public opinion is also vital for appropriate military intervention. We have had the extremes. On one hand, public opinion has been fed the hype surrounding the initial invasions of Somalia and Iraq, the photographers on the beach in Somalia, and shock and awe in Iraq. On the other hand, we have seen the cringing feebleness of the United Nations in Rwanda and of the Dutch in Bosnia. Public opinion has to come around to supporting interventions like that of the British in Sierra Leone. If Iraq is allowed to become another Somalia with the cry, "Never intervene," the consequences will be as bad as Rwanda. It would help a lot if countries other than the United States, Britain, and France took up a greater share of the burden. For example, Germany and Japan cannot forever hide behind their history or their absence from the Security Council as an excuse for non-participation. They are big countries with an important role to play. But it is not just the rich countries that need to step up to the plate. The South African government bravely tried to negotiate a settlement in Côte d'Ivoire. It failed, but its ambition was right. I would like to see the leading African states with yet more ambition to bring peace to the continent. Mobilizing changes in our laws and the promulgation of international charters. The big obstacle to changing our own laws is the free rider problem. Remember, each country would rather not act alone and disadvantage its firms. This is the perfect cause for the big international NGOs. With memberships in all the major countries, the NGOs can overcome the free rider problem that constrains each government. In effect, we need an alliance between the NGOs and the OECD, which is the bureaucracy for intergovernmental coordination. International charters could be powerful forces for improving governance in the bottom billion. Charters would empower the reformers within their societies, and also enable those countries at the early stages of turnaround to lock in change. They would provide an improved commitment technology. Remember that the reformers at present face an acute dilemma. They can only convincingly reveal their type through kamikaze reform strategies. If charters would strengthen reformers and make it easier for reforming governments to distinguish themselves from the villains, then some current governments certainly will be less than enthusiastic about their promulgation. I can already hear accusations of neo-colonialism tripping off the tongue of Robert Mugabe. Given this sort of opposition, who is going to champion them? The promulgation of charters can be done by several processes. We already have many of them. They do not have to be done by the General Assembly of the United Nations, and given Mugabe and his ilk, this route is unlikely. The Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative was launched by the British government. That was enough to get it started, and it has progressed well. Its successor should probably be transferred to one of the international organizations most appropriate for economic management. The boards of these organizations would be appropriate for authorization of something that is voluntary. Similarly, budget processes would lodge most naturally with the IMF, as it already has responsibility for annual consultations with member governments under Article 4 of its Articles of Agreement. The Charter for Post-Conflict Governance could be promulgated by the new Peace-Building Commission of the United Nations. Launched in September 2005, it has yet to be given a role, but it is evident that it is seen as a coordinating entity rather than as an implementing agency. A charter would be the ideal way of achieving coordination. The most difficult charters to place are the political ones, on campaign finance and on checks and balances. The IMF and the World Bank are prohibited by their own rules from involvement in political matters. The United Nations, though obviously political, is subject to the blocking veto of China, which is extremely concerned to head off any suggestion that democracy should be an international standard. One body that could propose political standards would be the European Commission. After all, the EU has explicit standards of democracy that are required for membership. It should not feel squeamish about projecting those standards onto a wider stage than Europe. The promulgation of international standards applied to its members, and more importantly to its prospective members, has been the core business of the European Commission. Its financial role remains puny, with only around 1% of European GDP passing through it. It is its regulatory role that gives it significance. Yet to date, in its approach to the bottom billion, the Commission has relied exclusively on its aid program. It has not been playing to its strength. Another possible body to promulgate political standards is the British Commonwealth. After all, the largest country in the Commonwealth is India, which has a longer tradition of democracy than many countries with much higher incomes. India has the prestige to use the Commonwealth to launch a credible charter of minimum standards for the conduct of democracy. Another possible way of promulgating political standards is through clubs. For example, the four Latin American countries of Mercosur have decided that democracy would be a condition for membership. Apparently, that helped to avert a coup. The big clubs, such as the African Union, don't work too well in this regard because their membership is indiscriminate. What is needed is small new clubs of the like-minded, adopting standards that set them apart, but which are capable of expansion, essentially open-access clubs of adherence to charters. Mobilizing changes in trade policy. With trade policy, self-interest meets ignorance and duly manipulates it. Rich country protectionism masquerades in alliance with anti-globalization romantics and third world crooks. The critical changes in trade policy, temporary protection of the bottom billion from Asia in our markets, are politically difficult not because they threaten interests, they don't, but because they do not fit into any of the current slogans and so don't make it onto the agenda. Protection against Asia is not about justice, fairness, or resisting globalization. Rather, it is about pulling the marginalized countries aboard. As we have seen, the development lobbies themselves, notably the big Western NGO charities, often just don't understand trade. It is complicated and doesn't appeal to their publics, so they take the populist line. Even former US President Bill Clinton, that great communicator, said that the hardest idea he ever had to get across to the American electorate was the notion of comparative advantage, that every country can produce something that can be exported to mutual advantage, which is the foundation concept in international trade. Indeed, if you remember what happened during the WTO meeting at Seattle in 1999, when American protectionists allied on the streets with anti-globalization NGOs, you will realize that he failed. But even more fundamental than this toxic brew is the problem that within the WTO, trade policy is determined by national trade representatives who see their role as negotiating a deal. Within this framework, there is no scope for using trade policy as an instrument for development. For trade policy to become an instrument of development, ministries of trade have to be ordered to change their priorities from extracting the best bargain to fostering development in the bottom billion. But ordered by whom? This takes us beyond the instrument-by-instrument approach, where we hit four final problems of coordination and focus. Problems of coordination. Within each government, the four instruments are lodged in different ministries. Only the development ministries, such as the Department for International Development in the United Kingdom, have development as their objective, and the only instrument that they control is aid. So there is over-reliance upon aid, and the development ministries come to define themselves as lobbies for aid rather than as lobbies for development. Success is measured by the size of the aid budget rather than by measures for development. A development minister is much happier talking about how to get aid to 0.7% of GDP, the UN target, than about the role of military intervention. Thus, the ministry with a nominal responsibility for development has a built-in bias toward one of the four instruments. And because development ministries are pretty low in the government pecking order, they have little sway in inter-ministerial discussions. Expecting the development ministry to persuade the central bank to do something about repatriating corrupt bank deposits is like expecting the general staff to adopt a battle plan drawn up by the catering corps. The objective of development has to be elevated above the level of the development ministry. Because four different branches of government need to be coordinated, the only level of government likely to be effective is the top. The head of government has to accept development of the bottom billion as a personal priority. Obviously, I do not mean that this should be the main priority, for that is unrealistic. Rather, because development requires so much policy coordination, it should be recognized as one of those objectives that need to be lodged officially at the top of government. In fact, heads of government are surprisingly keen to take on development as a public objective. Think of the eagerness of George W. Bush to share a platform with Bono. Think of Tony Blair launching the Commission for Africa. What has been lacking is not the commitment, so much as the serious content that should follow in its wake. We have had leadership without an adequate agenda, because to date, the agenda has been dominated by aid. Bush used his photo opportunity with Bono to announce the Millennium Challenge account. The Commission for Africa produced a wide-ranging report, but during the ensuing election season, it dwindled into a campaign to double aid. A head of government should not be leading an aid campaign. Rather, he or she should be forcing policy coordination across the government. That is the head of government's unique role, because no one else can do it. The other coordination problem is between governments. This is the global public good problem of free riders. Fixing the problem of the bottom billion would help everyone, so let's hope someone else does it. Without that mythical world government, the major governments of the world have to work together to address the problem. The only forum for doing this at present is the G8. If the G8 imagines that it has fixed the problem of the bottom billion by doubling aid to Africa at the 2005 summit, it had better do a reality check. Aid alone is not going to resolve this problem. However, given the Glen Eagles decision, the urgent matter is now to bring on the other three instruments: security, trade, and standards. These three were already neglected relative to aid even before aid was doubled. Now the imbalance is even more pronounced. Coordination on military interventions, trade policies, and international standards is going to be difficult because of recent history. Coordination on military intervention is clouded by the spectacular disagreements over Iraq. Coordination on trade policy is clouded by the spectacular disagreements on steel and agriculture. And coordination on international standards is clouded by the spectacular disagreements on climate change and the Kyoto Protocol. The recent track record is thus hardly propitious. However, the rich world has a strong collective interest in coordinating its policies to support the bottom billion, regardless of its internal disagreements on these other matters. With proper leadership, cooperation on policies for the bottom billion, where there is little need for friction, could even re-establish the spirit of cooperation in other areas. The G8 meeting of 2007 in Germany is the next opportunity for coordinated leadership, and quite properly, Africa is again on the agenda. Problems of focus. The Millennium Development Goals were, in one sense, a big advance. Compare them with an earlier UN Jamboree, the Copenhagen Social Summit of 1995. The Social Summit ended with a clarion call about how much should be spent on social priorities. The Millennium Development Goals encouraged people to shift their agenda from inputs to outcomes, halving poverty, getting children in school, and so forth. But despite this advance, the goals have two weaknesses, both involving a lack of focus. The first critical lack of focus is that the MDGs track the progress of 5 billion of the 6 billion people on our planet. It is, of course, politically easier for the United Nations to include almost everyone. Plus, the aid agencies prefer a wide definition of the development challenge because that justifies a near global role for their staff. The price we pay is that our efforts are spread too thin, and the strategies that are appropriate only for the countries at the bottom get lost in the general babble. It is time to redefine the development problem as being about the countries of the bottom billion, the ones that are stuck in poverty. When I give this message to audiences and aid agencies, people shuffle uncomfortably in their seats. Some of them may be thinking, but what about my career? For it would no longer be in Rio, but in Bangui. And when I give the message to an NGO audience, they get uneasy for a different reason. Many of them do not want to believe that for the majority of the developing world, global capitalism is working. They hate capitalism and do not want it to work. The news that it is not working for the billion at the bottom is not good enough. They want to believe that it does not work anywhere. But we cannot go on sacrificing the bottom billion to either of these self-serving aspirations. The other critical lack of focus is on strategies to achieve the goals. Growth is not a cure-all, but the lack of growth is a kill-all. Over the past 30 years, the bottom billion has missed out on global growth of unprecedented proportions. This failure of the growth process is the overwhelming problem that we have to crack. I have tried to show you how breaking the constraints upon growth will require a customized strategy. The same approach is not going to work everywhere, but neither is each country utterly distinctive. Governments in the countries of the bottom billion need to develop strategies appropriate for their circumstances. In principle, they do already, except that in practice, their strategies are usually more like shopping lists presented to donors. This deformation of strategic thinking is in part a result of the overemphasis upon aid. The strategies turn into shopping lists because the objective is not growth, but aid. The governments of the bottom billion need to become more ambitious. What can ordinary people do? Our approach toward the bottom billion has been failing. Many of these societies are heading down, not up, and they are collectively diverging from the rest of the world. If we let this continue, our children are going to face an alarmingly divided world and all its consequences. It does not have to be like that. The bottom billion are not condemned to slip in and out of war. They face a range of possible futures. Compared to the Cold War, the challenge of developing the bottom billion is scarcely daunting, but it does require us to get serious. That requires a change of attitude on the part of Western electorates, both left and right. The left needs to move on from the West's self-flagellation and idealized notions of developing countries. Poverty is not romantic. The countries of the bottom billion are not there to pioneer experiments in socialism. They need to be helped along the already trodden path of building market economies. The international financial institutions are not part of a conspiracy against poor countries. They represent beleaguered efforts to help. The left has to learn to love growth. Aid cannot just be targeted for the photogenic social priorities. It has to be used to help countries break into export markets. At present, the clarion call for the left is Jeffrey Sachs's book, The End of Poverty. Much as I agree with Sachs's passionate call to action, I think that he has overplayed the importance of aid. Aid alone will not solve the problems of the bottom billion. We need to use a wider range of policies. The right needs to move on from the notion of aid as part of the problem, as welfare payments to scroungers and crooks. It has to disabuse itself of the belief that growth is something that is always there for the taking, if only societies would get themselves together. It has to face up to the fact that these countries are stuck, that competing with China and India is going to be difficult. Indeed, it has to recognize that private activity in the global market can sometimes generate problems for the poorest countries that need public solutions. And because not even the US government is big enough to fix these problems by itself, these public solutions will usually have to be cooperative. At present, the clarion call for the right is economist William Easterly's book, The White Man's Burden. Easterly is right to mock the delusions of the aid lobby. But just as Sachs exaggerates the payoff to aid, Easterly exaggerates the downside and again neglects the scope for other policies. We are not as impotent and ignorant as Easterly seems to think. So how does this involve ordinary people in rich societies? Electorates tend to get the politicians they deserve. A classic example in the rich democracies is something called the political business cycle. For years, governments routinely spent money just before an election to artificially boost the economy, facing up to the consequent mess only once re-elected. Eventually, electorates wised up to what was happening, and so the ploy no longer pulled in the votes. As a result, politicians now rarely try it. That sort of learning has to happen across the range of policies needed for the bottom billion. These shifts in thinking depend upon ordinary citizens, people who manage to read to the end of a book. Of course, in a book of this length, I cannot set out all the evidence, but I hope that I have convinced you of three central propositions, each unfortunately fairly novel, that encapsulate how thinking needs to change. The first is that the development problem we now face is not that of the past 40 years. It is not the 5 billion people of the developing world and the Millennium Development Goals that track their progress. It is a much more focused problem of around a billion people in countries that are stuck. This is the problem we are going to have to tackle, and if we stick with present efforts, it is likely to be intractable, even as the dashboard indicators of world poverty get better and better. The second is that within the societies of the bottom billion, there is an intense struggle between brave people who are trying to achieve change and powerful groups who oppose them. The politics of the bottom billion is not the bland and sedate process of the rich democracies, but rather a dangerous contest between moral extremes. The struggle for the future of the bottom billion is not a contest between an evil rich world and a noble poor world. It is within the societies of the bottom billion, and to date, we have largely been bystanders. The third is that we do not need to be bystanders. Our support for change can be decisive, but we will need not just a more intelligent approach to aid, but complementary actions using instruments that have not conventionally been part of the development armory. Trade policies, security strategies, changes in our laws, and new international charters. In short, we need to narrow the target and broaden the instruments. That should be the agenda for the G8. Postscript. It is tempting, given the opportunity to add a postscript, to start writing a new book. At the core of the bottom billion is a set of policy proposals. I am going to focus on whether these ideas have taken root. My initial motivation for writing the book was a realization that our politicians would only move beyond gestures once there was a critical mass of informed citizens. To my astonishment, more than 50,000 copies of The Bottom Billion were sold in the first few months. Even before this new paperback edition, it was being translated into Chinese, Japanese, German, Spanish, French, Italian, Korean, and Norwegian. The critical mass is rapidly being built. So, has it made a difference? Are policymakers taking notice? At the level of political announcements, there has certainly been a sea change. The countries of the bottom billion are now receiving attention, and the need to accelerate their economic growth is being recognized. Fortuitously, there is new leadership in many of the key positions, and so there is less resistance than usual to new thinking. Ban Ki-moon, the new Secretary General of the United Nations, announced in his 2008 New Year message, "Let 2008 be the year of the bottom billion." Robert Zoellick, the new president of the World Bank, announced in his first annual meeting address that a stronger focus on the bottom billion would now be a priority. Douglas Alexander, the new British Secretary of State for Development, announced the creation of a massive international growth center for the poorest countries. Dominic Strauss-Kahn, the new Managing Director of the International Monetary Fund, has initiated a radical rethink as to how the fund might better serve low-income countries. I could go on with examples of the great and the good starting to pay attention, but will it amount to practical change? I think that there are prospects for change in three specific areas that would make a difference. The big story for many countries of the bottom billion is the commodity booms. It is their best opportunity for transformation, and it is vital that the failure to harness the booms of the 1970s should not be repeated. In the bottom billion, I propose some voluntary international standards for the successful management of the revenues from these booms, and this idea has been taken up by several of the international institutions, by NGOs, and by some governments. I now think it likely that soon there will be such standards. Having been drawn into policy discussions by several of the governments of the bottom billion, my conviction that they would make a difference has been reinforced. Many governments would welcome clear guidance. Since the millennium, several of the civil wars that beset the bottom billion have ended. But post-conflict situations are fragile. One of the proposals in the bottom billion is for a charter to guide policy in these situations. A charter would recognize the interdependence of three key decision-takers: the governments that provide peacekeepers, the governments that provide aid, and the post-conflict governments that determine the pace of reform. A charter would also recognize that there is no quick fix. Post-conflict reconstruction is a long-term process. This idea has also been taken up. Ban Ki-moon invited me to address the annual retreat of the Security Council, and the new Peacebuilding Commission of the United Nations is actively working on it, ably led by the Japanese, who invited me to Tokyo. I am hopeful that the future management of post-conflict situations will be substantially more successful than the disturbing record. The final policy concerns trade. Since writing this book, I have worked with Tony Venables, one of the world's leading international economists, comparing the American scheme, the African Growth and Opportunities Act, with the European version, Everything But Arms. We show that AGOA has been remarkably successful despite limitations in its design. It has increased African garments exports around sevenfold. In contrast, EBA has been ineffective. Venables and I met with Peter Mandelson, the European Trade Commissioner, and he was supportive of reform. But clearly, what is needed is not merely a better European scheme, but a pan-OECD temporary preference for those low-income countries that have not yet broken into global markets for manufactures. The obstacle to change has been a fear of further complicating the Doha Round, the stalled attempt to liberalize international trade under the auspices of the World Trade Organization. The upshot is that a change that would make a significant difference to the bottom billion I ignored. Concerns that it would be incompatible with a WTO are misplaced. The WTO has an escape clause for least developed countries, and in this context, that should mean those low-income countries that have not yet established significant manufactured exports. AGOA has been in place for years without the WTO getting upset, so the refusal to consider a common scheme to replace distinct American and European schemes is frankly ridiculous. This is an area where pressure is still needed. Pressure works, but it needs to be organized. This is the domain of the NGOs and the rock stars. Again, I have been astonished by the response. World Vision, the largest of the development NGOs, invited me to address their board, and we are now working together. Christian Aid will be represented on the advisory board of my research center. They tell me that they have changed staffing on trade policy. Bono and Bob Geldof have both been vigorous and passionate ambassadors for the policy proposals. TED and Skoll, the two extraordinary conferences for social action, both invited me to speak. You can view the speech on the internet. So I'm hopeful that with new leaders in the international community, a more informed citizenry, and the opportunity provided by the commodity booms, the future of the bottom billion will be better than the past. But the political struggle within their societies remains tough. Two of the heroines of the bottom billion, Ngozi Nkonjo-Iweala and Obi Ezekwesili, are no longer in the Nigerian government. In Kenya, the worst nightmares of John Gitongo were realized. The people of Zimbabwe are at the polls as I write. My recent research has focused on these political struggles. Suppressing the urge to tell you about it in this postscript, I refer you to my next book.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of The Bottom Billion, Why the Poorest Countries Are Failing and What Can Be Done About It. Written by Paul Collier. Narrated by Gideon Emery. Executive producer, Jennifer Basick. Producer, Mike Charzuk. Directed and engineered by Dion Audio Services, Inc. Edited by Dion Audio Services, Inc. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2007, Oxford University Press. Production copyright 2009, Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.